We'll chant together. Om Bhadram Karne Vishvinu Yama Deva Bhadram Pashye Makshabhir Yajatra Stirairangaihi Stushtuvagam Satanubihi Vyashema Deva Hitanyadayuhu Swasti na Indro Vridashravaha Swasti na Pusha Vishwavedaha Swasti na Starkshyo Harishtanemi Swasti no Brahaspatir Dadhatu Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi.
Very good. Let's get back to our text.
So where we are in the Mandukya, we just saw that seventh mantra with all the negation going on. That has got to be one of the most profound teachings to be found. One of the most profound teachings to be found anywhere in Vedanta. Thank you. And now we have Gaudapada's exposition of that seventh mantra, in which we finished this last line. So the earlier mantras were about the waking state, dream state, and deep sleep state. Now we come to the fourth, Turiyam, which, as you know very well, is not a state of experience at all. It is the one unchanging consciousness because of which the three states of experience exist. It is the consciousness that illumines the activities of your mind when you're awake. It's the consciousness that illumines your dreams and the consciousness that illumines the absence of activity in your mind when you're in deep sleep. That is called Turiya, the fourth, and sadly it gets called state incorrectly. It is not a state, it is not a state of experience, to put it very clearly. And how is that? If it is not a state of experience, then how do you reach it? That's everyone's question, right? What experience do I need to reach that fourth state? Well, it's not a state of experience, it's a consciousness present in all the three states of experience. So, fact of the matter is, you've already reached it. It's never been away from you or remote in any sense whatsoever. What is the problem? If it's already here now, but not recognized. We have so many stories that describe the failure to recognize something that's already present. You know, the Dashama Purusha, the tenth man story, is famous, or the simple story of the lady who couldn't find her necklace. She looked in every room of the house, inside, outside. She couldn't find her necklace. She already has it. It's already present. What is the problem? Well, the last line says here that turiyam padam ashnute. Turiyam here is called a padam, not an avastha. Avastha is a state of experience. Padam has several meanings, one of which is goal. That which is to be reached is padam, goal. So turiyam padam, the goal which is the fourth, ashnute, is enjoyed, literally, is reached, is attained, when viparyase tayohu kshine. When there is the kshina, the removal of viparyasa, of error. Tayohu, both kinds of error. What are the two kinds of error? We've talked about now at great length. We've talked about tattva, These are complicated words, so I'll put them back up on the board. So the two kinds of error we're dealing with, one is tattva agrahana. These are Shankaracharya's words, agrahana, and anyatha grahana. Agrahana, absence of grasping, failure to cognize the tattva, the reality. We call this non-recognition. This will summarize all of last week's class. And anyatha grahana, grasping otherwise. Understanding something incorrectly, we call that misapprehension. And these English words, I think, are quite accurate. So non-recognition, in this case, self-non-recognition, failure to recognize your own true nature, which is then followed by misapprehension or superimposition of what you're not. Failing to recognize the rope, you project the snake. Failing to recognize your true nature as pure consciousness, you superimpose, I am male, female, young, old, etc., etc., goes on, happy, sad, goes on forever. So these are the, this is the problem in Vedanta, what prevents you from enjoying absolute fullness and completeness, we call enlightenment. What prevents that is, are these two, and the words we've used more frequently in past classes are the two kinds of avidya, or two shaktis of avidya, one being avarana, the covering capacity or aspect of avidya, and vikshepa, the projecting capacity of avidya, and it summarizes everything we saw in the last class. So now we're going to continue as Gaudapada continues to unfold this teaching. Before we do, we've got two questions here. Good questions, we'll take very briefly. First question, in which state is there only consciousness and no ignorance? In which state? So is there ignorant in which state? Waking state, dream state, or deep sleep state? When is there consciousness and no ignorance? Well, it depends. If you're not yet enlightened, there is ignorance in the waking state, there is ignorance in the deep state, in dream state, and there is ignorance in deep sleep. If you're enlightened, there's no ignorance in the waking state, there's no ignorance in the dream state, and there's no ignorance in deep sleep. And when you're talking about turiya, ignorance has no bearing whatsoever, because ignorance belongs to the mind and not consciousness. Turiya has no ignorance. Turiya doesn't need Vedanta, as we've discussed before. The second of the questions. When a person wakes up from a dream that included pain, he or she is completely free from the dream pain. This is like waking up. This situation was compared to a person waking up from the cloud of ignorance, becoming enlightened. The newly enlightened person still feels physical pain but reacts differently, which is different from the dream. When you wake up from the dream, dream experience is over. When you wake up from the dream of ignorance, in fact, that's our topic for today. When you wake up from the dream of ignorance, when you wake up from the dream of duality, does your experience of duality come to an end? If it came to an end, as soon as you became enlightened, you'd be incapable of interacting in the world in any way whatsoever. So quite different. When you wake up from the dream, the dream experience comes to an end. When you wake up from ignorance, your experience of duality continues, but you no longer take it to be real. We're going to be discussing that in today's class. So, but the question is, so the difference between an enlightened person and an unenlightened person, is it merely an attitude shift? Not attitude, knowledge. It's a shift from ignorance to knowledge. That's all it is. We could say the mere removal of ignorance is a difference between an unenlightened and enlightened person. But then the interesting comment is, doesn't this get reduced to mere psychology? Or is it deeper than that? Is Vedanta psychology? Is this merely psychology? Well, consider, there's a famous quote that we studied here long ago, mana eva manushyanam karanam bandha moksha yoho. Some of you will remember that. It comes from this Amrita Bindu Upanishad. Comes elsewhere also. But it says that manushyanam, for all people, the karana, the cause for bandha and moksha, for bondage and liberation, the cause is manas eva, mind alone. The locus of ignorance is in your mind. Can't be anywhere else. So where does Vedanta have to address the problem? In your mind. So the ignorance in your mind is removed by Vedanta, which takes place in the form of vrittis in your mind. Is that psychological? It's not psychological in the sense of therapy. Therapy is something. A therapeutic process is very, very different. Therapeutic processes address a lot of emotional issues. Don't get me wrong. Therapy can be extremely important for some people. But here, that we're not describing a therapeutic process at all. But it is a process that takes place in your mind and nowhere else. The problem is in your mind. The solution is in your mind. Okay, these are the questions. Now we can proceed where we left off. Yes. Anadi maya yasukto, anadi maya yasuk, yada jiva prabuddhyate, yada jiva ajamanidramaswapnam, advaitam buddhyate tada, yada, when, Jiva, the living being, the person who is sitting in your chair, yada jivaha, when that jiva, who, according to Gaudapada, is suptaha, asleep. According to Gaudapada, you're still asleep. Not in the state of dream, the sleep of ignorance. So he uses this metaphor very deliberately. So yada, when, jivaha, you who are suptaha, dreaming in a state which is not enlightened under the effects of the sleep of ignorance. And he says very clearly, anadi mayaya suptaha, you are suptaha, you are asleep due to anadi maya. Maya, which is anadi, beginningless. Beginningless maya. One thing you should know in Advaita Vedanta is very frequently maya is used as a synonym for avidya. Be ready for that. It's used a lot in that sense. Maya means ignorance. In this context, maya means ignorance and nothing else. Of course, ignorance at a cosmic level gives rise to the entire universe, but we're not talking about a cosmic level. We're talking about your experience. Maya, at the level of your experience right now, is simply understood as ignorance, nothing but ignorance. So, anadi mayaya, due to this beginningless maya, means due to beginningless ignorance, you are sleeping. First of all, beginningless ignorance? Ignorance is beginningless by definition. Suppose ignorance had a beginning. That means it would be preceded by a state which wasn't ignorant. So knowledge. So after knowledge you become ignorant? It doesn't make any sense. The point I'm making is ignorance is one of the few things that we can identify which is truly beginningless. Like Ishvara is beginningless. Avidya is ignorant, is beginningless. But there's one unique feature about this beginningless ignorance. Everything, almost everything else that's beginningless is endless. Ishvara has no beginning, therefore no end. Consciousness has no beginning, no end. Brahman, reality, has no beginning, no end. Ignorance has no beginning. Oh, that's interesting. The ignorance which has existed from beginningless time comes to an end with knowledge. That's something unique about ignorance. And just to make one point clear about when we say beginningless ignorance. So, when you're born, are you born enlightened or ignorant? You're born ignorant. So we start with avidya. Many of you have seen this several times. So due to ignorance of your true nature, you fail to recognize your innate divinity, your essential fullness and completeness, and therefore you feel kama, desire. And because of desire, you're driven to act, to fulfill your desires, karma. And the karmas you commit, some of the pala is fructified in this life, some doesn't get fructified in this life. So when you die, some karma is left over. That leftover karma demands to be fructified. This is the doctrine of karma. So in order to have the leftover karma fructify, you are driven to take another birth. And when you're born the next time, are you born enlightened or ignorant? And this is the endless loop we are all stuck in. Remember, as a young engineering student, we had talked about the endless loops in software, which happens a lot. By the way, when your computer fails to respond to you, you do a control alt delete, you do bang on it, whatever you do, and your computer just sits there, and you think your computer is dead. In fact, it's not. It's working furiously. But what it's doing is this little useless task. It's just doing it. It's like OCD. It's doing it again and again and again and again. And it ignores. It's so busy doing this useless task that it ignores you. That's what happens when your computer stops working. It's not. It's working. It's just ignoring you, like your spouse. Anyway, sorry to completely off track here. But the point I'm making is this anadi maya describes this endless loop. And what's so significant about this endless loop, even though it has its origin in eternity, which means it's a beginningless loop, unlike your computer, but this loop has an end. It is brought to an end with knowledge, ignorance. Even though ignorance is beginningless, it has an end. So, you are suptaha. Even now, you are, supta means dreaming. And I made a point here. You want, here is Shankara's explanation of what it is to be dreaming. Again, dream of ignorance, not your dream at night. The dream of ignorance, according to Shankara, is when you think like this. Mama ayam pita. That this is my father. Putraha ayam napta. And this son of mine is my father's grandson. And, by the way, this is dream. This is what Shankara considers to be your dream. When you think about your father, when you think about your son, Shankara and Gaudapada are calling it a dream of sorts. Kshetram pashavaha aham esham swami. I am the owner of this land and these animals, farmer. Sukhi, dukhi, sometimes I'm happy, sometimes I'm sad. Kshayataha aham anena, when I'm sad, then I feel low. Varditaha cha anena, and when I'm happy, I feel up. This is his description of a dream. You're thinking, but that sounds like normal life. That's the point. That's exactly the point. What you take as normal life, according to Gaudapada, Shankaracharya, and anyone who really is enlightened, you are living in a dream world, in a state of ignorance. And we're talking about coming out of that. We'll let the text explain what that's about and how we come out of it. So that jiva, you, sitting in your chair, being sleeping due to this eternal ignorance, yada buddhyate, but when you wake up, and again, and here, it's when you wake up out of ignorance. And what is required to wake up out of ignorance? All the teachers would say two factors are required: shastra and guru. Shastra are these teachings, and guru is someone to help you understand the teaching. So shastra and guru, teachings and guru are required with their help. Prabuddhyate, you wake up out of that eternal dream, and then what? Tada, end of the verse, then buddhyate. Then there is knowledge. One wakes up to the reality. And what is the reality? The reality described here as ajam, unborn, anidram, free from sleep, aswapnam, free from dream, advaitam, free from duality. We'll explain each of these words, but notice first they're all negative again. They're all words of negation. You already are Sachidananda Atma. And if your mind, just an important point, when your mind stops making trouble, all that's left is Sachidananda Atma. And seriously, in deep sleep, your mind stops making trouble. You feel blissful. In deep meditation, your mind stops making trouble. You feel blissful. The problem is not that you miss out on anything, but the problem is the mischief of the mind. And that mischief of the mind is a result of ignorance. When the mischief of the mind is removed, when the ignorance of the mind is removed, then you recognize your true nature to be ajam, unborn. Shankara adds something here. Sarva bhava vikara varjita. We've talked about in prior Tuesday classes, this is a little bit of technical stuff in Vedanta, worth knowing. What are the shad bhava vikara? Six kinds of change. Six states that one might transit through in one's life. Six kinds of change. Vikara means change. So let's see these six kinds. What these are, this is what Shankara calls Shad is six, Bhava, which is state, Vikara, change. And we start Asti Jayate Vipari Namate. I'm missing one. Apachiyate. Which did I miss? I missed Jayate Vardhate. Yeah. There we go. Namate Vipari Namate Apachiyate. And Nashyati. Okay. So this is just very typical precision of Vedantic understanding. Ajam, unborn, points to changelessness. And the way we get from unborn to changelessness is being born is one of six kinds of change. And the six kinds of change are the Shad, Bhava, Vikara. So these are the six kinds of change you are subject to. First, Jayate. You're born. Then, Asti. You exist. I don't know if you can call that a change, but this is the traditional list. So Jayate, you're born. Then, Asti, then you exist. Then Vardhate, you grow, more change. Then Viparinamate, you undergo transformation. Then Apakshiyate, you undergo decay. We're all busy doing that at this point in our life, I'm afraid. And then finally, Nashyati, you die. So the point is in life, these are six kinds of change that every living being undergoes, and none of these apply to consciousness. So consciousness is not subject to any kind of bhava-vikara, state of change. So therefore, here, when the text says ajam, unborn, so ajam is referring to no jayate, no birth. So the term ajam is meant to bring to our minds all six of these states of change, and then we know that ajam means not only free from birth, but free from all kinds of change, changeless. Ajam literally means birthless, but contextually it means changeless. Your consciousness is changeless. And if out of this whole class, if that's the only thing you get, that's all you need. When you can recognize your consciousness as being changeless, if your consciousness is changeless, how does the sadness in your mind affect you? How does the pain in your body affect you? How does the loss of your financial wealth, how does that affect you? If you discover the changelessness of your consciousness, what do they say? Game over. You're done. Then, anidram, free from sleep. You can take this in two senses. Sleep being one of the three states of experience. Consciousness has no states of experience. Consciousness is utterly, we just said, unchanging, which means the same consciousness in the waking state is the same consciousness in the dream state, is the same consciousness in deep sleep. We've discussed that before. There's another way you can take anidram, sleepless. We just were referring to the sleep of ignorance. So you can also take this anidram as ignorance, in particular the avarana, the tattva agrahana. So anidram, free from sleep, or free from ignorance, free from self, non-recognition. And then aswapnam, free from dream, free from sleep and free from dream. So again, you can take it both ways. Free from deep sleep and free from dream state. That's an obvious meaning, but a more nuanced meaning. Very obvious, right? You can consciousness does not undergo deep sleep, nor does consciousness undergo the dream state, or for that matter, the waking state. But a more nuanced interpretation here is for consciousness, there is no nidram avarana, tattva agrahana, that aspect of ignorance. Nor is there any swapna, dream. And here we're talking about the dream of our everyday experience. We're talking about the dream that is projected due to ignorance. So dream can refer to this vikshepa shakti of avidya, or this anyata grahana. It's just a more sophisticated interpretation here. Both ways are fine. Consciousness is free from the three states of experience. Consciousness is also free from ignorance, as we said before. Ignorance doesn't belong to consciousness. Ignorance belongs to your mind. All right. And finally, advaitam, the consciousness that you are, which is ajam, unchanging, anidram, aswapnam, free from any state of experience, free from ignorance, that consciousness is advaitam. And that is something to be discovered with the help of these teachings. Independently, you can't figure this stuff out. There's no amount of logic or reasoning that would lead you to recognize your consciousness as being non-dual, your consciousness as being identical to the very fabric of existence. We require the teachings of Vedanta to discover that. So, yada jivaha buddhyate, when you wake up out of the dream of ignorance, then what? Tada, then buddhyate, then you recognize your true nature as being unchanging, non-dual consciousness. All right. Oh, last point here. I made a comment here. Please note then that there is no process of transformation involved here. So often, in spiritual life, there is absolutely a process of transformation. Transformation for whom? Does consciousness undergo transformation? We just established consciousness is unchanging. That which is unchanging can't go through any change. That's what that viparinamate means. That which undergoes change, consciousness is unchanging, therefore cannot be transformed. There is a process of transformation. That process of transformation is in our minds. Tremendous transformation that takes place in our minds. But for consciousness, there is no transformation. Okay, enough. Let's continue. We'll chant this, but I need to introduce it properly. Prapancho yadi vidyeta, prapancho yadi vidyeta. Nivarte tana samshayaha, nivarte tana maya matramidam dvaitam, maya matramidam advaitam paramartataha, advaitam paramartataha. Suppose someone were to argue, as people do, that when you wake up from the dream of ignorance, then advaita comes to an end. True or false? Tricky. As we hinted at before, when you wake up out of the dream of ignorance, if you have no experience of duality, and just to make a silly story, suppose in this class you get enlightened. So by the end of the class now, it's time to leave. How will you find the doorway? If everything is one what would that experientially be like? Everything would be gray, the same shade of gray, non-dual grayness, or whiteness. Everything is pure white. How do you recognize where the door is? How do you recognize your car? You get the point. If the experience of duality does not come to an end, then what about what about duality? If the experience of duality continues, what about non-duality? We'll let Gaudapada explain it. He says, yadi, if prapanchaha, this world of duality, if this world of duality vidyeta, this world of reality really existed, then nivarteta, then it would go away. If the world of duality truly existed, then it could go away, nasamshayaha, without doubt. If this world of duality really existed, this is a very sophisticated point. If this world of duality really existed, and if Vedanta really destroys the ignorance, which is the cause for duality, then the ignorance goes away, duality goes away, then all your experience goes away and we're in trouble. So then, how are we to understand this? Notice his use of the word if. What he means to say is, this world of duality doesn't really exist. If it did really exist, then enlightenment would make it go away. But it doesn't really exist. Did that snake ever really exist on the rope? There never was a snake, ever, at any time. So you can't really say the snake went away. I mean, in language, we may say, oh, the snake is gone. No, it was never there in the first place. And isn't that what you get when you recognize your mistake in a dark alley? It's not that you get rid of the snake, it's that rather that you come to understand that the snake never existed in the first place. Right? So this describes waking up out of the dream of ignorance. Waking up out of the dream of duality means you come to realize that everything you've ever experienced in life, that none of it was absolutely real. Everything you have ever experienced is not absolutely real. Did you experience it? Yes. But did you experience something that was absolutely real? You experience everything in the world like you experienced the snake. Here's a better example. Do you experience a pot? Certainly. But we've had this discussion so many times, you know very well, there's no pot here at all. There's only several ounces of clay. So look at that. Our experience constantly is in contact with, and not, our, I have to choose my words carefully here, give me a moment. Our experience brings us information about nama and rupa, names and forms. That's what experience is good for doing. Our experience of the world is an experience of nama rupa, including the name and form pot. What does experience tell you about clay? Nothing necessarily. Clay is to be understood. Pot is experienced. Clay is to be understood. The world is experienced. The underlying non-dual reality, because of which the world exists, must be understood. Experience does not determine reality. And this is a big problem in modern times. In modern times, we are so fixated on experience as being the ultimate determining factor of reality. By the way, helpful to put this in a historical context. 500 years ago, in Europe, up to 500 years ago in Europe, experience was not the final basis for reality. In Western culture, the final basis for reality, well, you won't like this at all. The ultimate authority on what is real and what is not real, up until 500 years ago in Europe, the final authority was the Roman Catholic Church. This is Western culture. The final authority on what is real or unreal in Europe, up until 500 years ago, was absolutely the Roman Catholic Church. Of course, that all got thrown out, and here we are 500 years later. No one pays attention to the church anymore at all, but we've come to rely, we've replaced, look at this. This is an interesting observation. I've never made this before. We've replaced one error with another one. So we've dethroned the Roman Catholic Church. Good. But we have elevated experience. And it turns out, just as a Roman Catholic Church is not the authority on what is real, in the same way your experience is not the authority on what is real. How many times have we talked about watching the sunset? You've never in your life experienced the sun going down. You've always experienced the earth rotating on its axis. We have to admit that experience is not the final authority on experience. So, we experience the pot, but we know it is clay. Notice the difference between experience and knowledge. And notice that they exist simultaneously. Let me get to the next line, and then I'll explain that. Knowledge and experience exist simultaneously. He says in the second line, maya matram idam dvaitam. Idam dvaitam, this world of duality that we exist, is maya matram. Again, maya means avidya, ignorance. So it's mere ignorance. It's a mere projection, that vikshepa shakti. The world we experience is not real. Maya matram, it's merely maya. It's merely experience. The pot is not real. The pot is a name and a form. Name is not a thing. Form is not a thing. The thing is clay. This is true about the pot, and it's true about everything else that you experience without exception. Anything you experience is not real. What a statement. This is Gaudapada. Gaudapada, he said anything, and we'll come to his actual statements later, but he's going to say in so many words, if you experience it, it's not real. Why? Because experience is only good enough to tell you about nama rupa, name and form. Experience is not good enough. It's not authority to tell you what is real. Maya matram idam dvaitam, this world of duality that we experience, is The tendency, everyone will say, it's mere illusion. Illusion is not a helpful word. This pot is not an illusion. If I throw it at you and it hits your head, you'll know that this pot is not illusory. So it's just an improper word. So name and form are not real, but it's not an illusion. We just have to give up that word. It's a very poor translation. Okay. So maya matram idam dvaitam, this world of duality we exist is mere ignorance. Advaitam paramartataha, but what is paramartataha? But in reality, what exists is advaita. Dvaita exists experientially, but in reality, what exists is advaita. It's simple. Experientially, pot. In reality, clay. Experientially, world of duality. But in reality, one non-dual fabric of existence that is not different from your consciousness. And what's significant here is that both of the... that's where I caught myself. Both duality... How to put this? We introduced a verse saying, if duality were real, it could go away. By the way, anything that goes away can come back. Right? Anything that goes away, except for ignorance, we'll make that one exception, with the exception of ignorance, anything that goes away can come back. So if you really get rid of this, in deep sleep and meditation, you get rid of duality. It's true, right? In deep sleep and in deep meditation, you get rid of duality. Then it comes back. That's the point. So he's making a different point here. He's saying that it is not something real that you get rid of. It's like getting rid of the snake. The snake was never there in the first place, which means the dawn of Advaita coexists with the experience of duality. I'll say that again. The dawn of Advaita, waking up out of the dream of ignorance to the reality of non-duality, that doesn't cause the experience of duality to go away. When you know that this is nothing but clay, do you still experience a pot or no? It's too simple. You continue to experience a pot even though you know it's clay. That's all it is. You continue to experience a world of duality even though you know what you see, hear, taste, smell, and touch is not as real as it seems. This is his point. This is something that's not even in the commentary, but it's something that I think is helpful. We keep using this rope snake thing, and it's extremely helpful, but it has a defect in our current context. And you see the context here is that when you recognize the rope, do you experience the snake anymore? No. So you see the defect. First of all, it's a metaphor. And metaphors always have a limited scope. So it's a metaphor used to show a specific thing. And we need to use the right metaphor for every context. And Vedanta has so many metaphors. Maybe we need another metaphor. And instead of the rope snake, a very commonly given metaphor to explain our experience and knowledge. It's given in many texts. It's not given here, but allow me to introduce it at this point. What color is air? Colorless. What color is the sky? Sure looks, during the day, sure looks blue. It looks blue. Now look at that. You know there's no blueness up there. You know air is clear. Actually, in ancient times, they would look up and they would see a giant inverted bowl. This is before we understood anything about astronomy. They would imagine that we are underneath this giant blue bowl. There's no bowl. Look at this. We know, with the benefit of science, that air is clear. We see the blue. We know the blue is an artifact of a refraction of light. We'll spare you the boring details. But notice you have knowledge of the clearness of air, and you still experience the blueness of the sky. You must be terribly conflicted. No? You can handle that, right? You can handle optical illusions. We know that our senses and things we experience can fool us, like the sunset. My favorite example is the sunset. Even though you know you're on this giant planet tilting over backwards, it sure looks like the sun is moving down. It happens to be an optical illusion. There's some science behind it. And we don't have any problem with that. Our experience is the sun is going down. Our knowledge is that the sun doesn't go down. So if you can handle it with the blue sky, if you can handle it with the sunset, we can, and when I say handle the apparent contradiction between what we experience and what we know. You experience blue sky, you know it's not blue. You experience the sun going down, you know it's not going down. In the same way you experience the world of duality, you can know with absolute certainty. There's no duality out there at all. Okay, next verse. Same idea with a little different perspective. Vikalpo venivarteta, vikalpo venivart, kalpito yadikena chata, kalpito yadi, upadeshadayam vadaha, upadeshadayam. Nyate dvaitam na vidyate, nyate dvaitam. We have to introduce this. First, the prior verse we introduced by saying, when you get enlightened, do you still experience duality? Here, variation on the theme. Right now, there is a guru, there is a shishya, and there is a shastra. That's duality, isn't it? So right now, we are functioning in the realm of duality. So now the question becomes, when you get enlightened, will you still experience a guru, a shishya, and a shastra, or will that experience go away? Well, it's actually very similar to the prior verse. He said, vikalpaha, and the vikalpa here specifically in the commentary, he says, vikalpa is a division. Here I say projection, division might be more accurate. The division between guru, teacher, shishya, student, and shastra, teaching. These divisions, vinivartate, it's the potential verb. They would go away These divisions between teacher, student, and scripture, they would go away, yadi, if they were kalpitaha, actually created or projected, kenachit, by someone. Almost the same as a prior verse. If they were really created, if they really existed, these divisions, then they would go away, and when you got enlightened, then I suppose you wouldn't see me sitting here anymore, nor would you see the doorway, nor would you see anything. We've discussed that already. But here, the new thing taught in this verse is the last part. Upadeshat ayam vadaha. This is something that's overlooked in some schools of thought. Ayam vadaha. These teachings, teachings which involve the duality of guru, shishya, and shastra, this kind of duality, ayam vadaha, these teachings are upadeshat. They are for the sake of teaching. And I need to make this point very clear. You may not have been exposed to this, but there are teachers that say, in fact, this is something called Neo-Advaita. Neo-Advaita is a modern corruption of the teachings of Shankaracharya. And a Neo-Advaita teacher would if you ask a Neo-Advaita teacher, please teach me, I'm in a state of bondage, I want moksha. And the Neo-Advaita teacher would say, you're not in a state of bondage. There is no bondage. Now that's interesting. That Neo-Advaita teacher, are they telling you the truth or not? That's the truth. So you say, please help me, please teach me, I'm in a state of bondage, please give me some spiritual wisdom. You say, and the Neo-Advaita teacher says, there's no problem. You have no bondage whatsoever, you were never bound. There is no such, and they go on further to say, there's no such thing as bondage and moksha. Correct or not? For consciousness, there's no bandha or moksha. So from that level, they're absolutely correct. But tell me, how does that help you as a student? Not at all, right? In fact, it's harmful because now your suffering has been dismissed. It's like when you go to a doctor and you say, doctor, I've got this terrible pain in my elbow. And the doctor says, oh, it's all in your head. That's not very hopeful, is it? Well, that's what Neo-Vedanta does. It says, your problem of bondage and moksha, it's all in your head. Which from one man, by the way, when a doctor says it's all in your head, pain is experienced where? Not in your elbow. In fact, it's true. Pain happens to be experienced in your head. Your doctor is telling you the truth, but it's not helpful. So, in Advaita Vedanta, we recognize the empirical validity of the problem, which means the teacher and teaching steps down from the lofty realm of non-duality. The teacher and teaching step down to your level of duality, of ignorance. Teaching takes place at that level. Upadeshat ayam vadaha. Ayam vadaha, this teaching, this distinction between student, teacher, and teaching, this is all upadeshat. It's all from the standpoint of teaching. It's all necessary. It's all practical. And it certainly is very impractical to take this really lofty. Again, this is Neo-Vedanta, and by the way, I am not misrepresenting them. A Neo-Vedantin will truly say, you have no bondage. They'll start with that, and it's not helpful. What distinguishes Advaita Vedanta is its method of teaching. We can admit that Neo-Vedanta and Advaita Vedanta teach the same thing. There is only one reality, and that one reality happens to be non-dual. But what distinguishes Advaita Vedanta and makes it unique and powerful is its methodology, the method of teaching. We call them prakriyas, the methods that are employed. So, the prakriya, the methodology of Vedanta, is to acknowledge the empirical reality of the problem and to treat the problem at its own level. Okay, now said, jñāte dvaitam na vidyate. When you become enlightened, jñāte, then dvaitam na vidyate. Then you understand there is no difference between guru, shishya, and shastra. When you become enlightened, but until that time, we function in a realm of duality. All right. And with that verse, Gaudapada concludes his discussion on that seventh mantra, that very important, the most important mantra in this whole Upanishad. And now we take an interesting turn. We'll just begin this tonight, and we won't go much further. But we return now to the Upanishad. Remember the Upanishad opened with Om. It said Om is a name for Brahman. And then it went on to say that Om, that Brahman, has four parts, etc. And then we talk about the waking dream and deep sleep state and Turiya, the fourth. So we've had all that discussion. Now we return to Om. And before we go back, I just want to put a bug in your ear, so to speak. Why are we going back to Om? We're already done with Om. Now we're going back. So just put that in the back of your mind that there's something funny going on here. This is something that's often not recognized. But just with that in mind, that something odd is happening here because we're going backwards, so to speak. Let's see this. Now we leave Gaudapada's Karika aside, and now we return to the mantras of the Upanishad. Let's see this mantra and then return to this discussion. Saha ayam atma, saha ayam atma, adhyaksharam omkaraha, adhyaksharam omkara, adhimatram padaha, matraha, adhimatram padaha, matraha, matraha cha padaha, matraha cha padaha, akaraha, ukaraha, makaraha, iti, akaraha, ukaraha, makaraha, iti. And I'm breaking all the words apart here. Usually in a verse, I won't break them apart, but in these mantras, my tendency is to break everything apart. So, saha ayam atma. This atma that we've been discussing, from the very beginning of the Upanishad. Where is the beginning? There it is. So, Om Iti Etad Aksharam Idam Sarvam Tasya Vend Abhutam Bhavat. Yeah, okay. Tat Omkara Eva. Everything is Omkara. So that we began with that statement that everything is Omkara. Everything is Om. Omkara means a syllable Om. And everything means what? Everything that you experience, so waking, dream, deep sleep, and the consciousness because of which they exist. Everything is Om. Now we come back to that Om. Saha ayam atma, this atma that we've been discussing, this atma which is that consciousness present in a waking state, dream state, and deep sleep state, that atma, that consciousness, adhyaksharam omkaraha, that consciousness is om, omkara, the syllable om, adhyaksharam, from the standpoint of the syllable. So from the standpoint of the syllable om, om represents atma. And that's a restatement of the whole first part of the text. So remember that this Upanishad is exactly 12 mantras long, and we're on mantra 8. You see that M8 means mantra number 8. So the first 7 mantras were about Om from the standpoint of Adhyaksharam, the Om itself, meaning as a symbol representing reality, representing Turiya, representing consciousness, of course the consciousness present in all experience, waking, dream, and sleep. Now, something new comes. Omkaraha adhimatra. So, as opposed to adhi-aksharam, with regard to the syllables, now we're seeing adhi-matra. Akshara is a syllable, matra, yeah, but duration is, take it as letter. It doesn't literally mean letter, but it'll make sense. So om as a syllable is a sound symbol representing atma, but now we're starting something new. Adhi matram, with regard to the letters of om, we have matraha, letters which are padaha, padas, and the padas being waking, dream, and deep sleep states. And then he says matraha cha padaha, he's just switching the words apart. The letters are the states of experience, and the states of experience are the letters. And what are those letters? Akaraha, ukaraha, makaraha, iti. The letters a, u, and ma. Now, first of all, there are several things to be discussed here. Om. Two moments of grammar. Om equals the letters O and Ma. In fact, some of you, if you're from an Arya Samaj background, you've seen this. Have you ever seen that? O three M. And the three means this O is extra long. Short syllables are one unit long. Long syllables like O are two units long. And here, the number three means it's extra long. Prolated is a letter, what grammarians call three units long, which means its proper pronunciation is not OM, short, nor is it OM, medium, but it is OM, three units long. Anyway, the point I'm making is that the letters are O and MA, and what do we get as U? So you just said A, U, MA, and by the way, I have to share with you my pet peeve. That is absolutely incorrect, to write in English letters A, U, MA. So if you write it like that, you should pronounce it AUM. But it's not Aum, it's Om. I hope you will never ever pronounce Om. Can I share with you this joke? So few of you will remember this. I've told it before. This is a true story told by Swami Dayananda, my guru. Some of you know this story. It is one of the most hilarious stories, so, and we're at the end. I think we'll end with this story because this is a heavy topic. Better that we should end with this story. When you may not know that Pujya Swami Dayananda was quite mischievous. And this is a story that illustrates his mischievousness. When he was in his 20s, he was visiting an ashram, someplace in South India. And in this ashram, they were all chanting, Aum, Aum, which is extremely non-traditional. It's wrong. It's absolutely wrong. But they were doing that. Aum. And he didn't understand, why are they chanting this Aum stuff? He didn't understand that at all. Anyway, later he was in the office of the manager. The manager was a sannyasi, not the swami in charge. The manager was also a swami. And they were having some conversation. And as they were having a conversation, there was a dog laying on the floor. And this dog got up and stretched out its front legs, bent its back, and it yawned. And as the dog yawned, it made this sound. Aum. Some sound like that. Hearing that, Pujya Swami Dayananda turned to the manager and said, I have one doubt. Very typical Indian English. Swamiji, I have one doubt. My doubt is, did the dog learn this from you? Or did you learn this from the dog? Now, can you imagine how mischievous he was? This is when he was in his 20s. And then he's still mischievous enough later in his life to tell this story in public. And he did. Anyway, and I'm sharing with you this story to make sure that you'll never write it A-U-M or ever pronounce it A-U-M. Those of you who know the language, would you ever write it like this? Never write it like that. If you won't write it like that, then why do you write it in English like this? That's my point. It's absolutely non-Sanskritic. It's absolutely incorrect. There, allow me just to make this observation. I don't know. This Hinduism Today group, you know, they publish, it's kind of a nice magazine, but they're fixated on this. And I don't understand why. Well, I do understand. We won't go into the details. Anyway, they're perpetuating a mistake in their well-read magazine. This is a problem. Now, the reason for getting this oo has to do with Sanskrit grammar. In Sanskrit grammar, the letter O can be grammatically deconstructed into a plus oo. The letter O can be grammatically deconstructed into a plus u. It's a grammatical deconstruction where o can be considered to be the combination of a and u. But one of the rules, this is actually a rule of Sunday, when a and u come together, they must join and form o. That's a grammar rule. If a and u come together, they must form o. So, if a and u are together, they form o. But if a and u form o, then couldn't we go backwards and grammatically deconstruct o into its parts, a and u? This is a grammatical deconstruction done for the sake of meditation. That's the topic we're about to see, is meditation based on the three syllables, a, u, ma. And we're going to begin with this mantra that we just started. The meditation is introduced. I hinted at something odd why meditation here? Generally, you do meditation first, and then you get into the teachings. Here we've got it in reverse order. We have to discuss that in the next class. Why do we go into meditation here? What is the purpose of this meditation? What is the nature of this meditation? It's a meditation based on the syllables ah, oo, ma. So we'll save all that for the next class.
Okay.
Om sarve bhavantu sukhinah, sarve santu niramayah, sarve bhadrani pashyantu, ma kashchid dukha bhag bhavet, asato ma sadgamaya, tamaso ma jyotirgamaya, mrityor ma amritangamaya. Om Shanti, 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 Om. Before you go, let me just mention, weather is turning cold now. I saw a few snowflakes today, which means you better sign up, if you haven't already done so, sign up for the class announcements. Because if we have to cancel a class due to bad weather or illness, the only way you'll find out is if you're signed up. Go to our website and sign up for the Tuesday night class announcements. Good night. See you soon.